DeSanto Propane is four generations strong as a trustworthy family-owned business with unmatched customer service. Go online at DeSantoPropane.com for more info or call toll-free at 1-800-752-4574. Since 1937, the difference has been DeSanto Propane.
Do you want to know what's happening in the Finger Lakes? We do too. We're going in depth with decision makers in the heart of upstate New York to get the answers you need. From the team of FingerLakes1.com, this is Inside the FLX.
How serious is the mental health crisis here in the Finger Lakes? The National Alliance on Mental Illness reports 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness each year, and the U.S. has seen its spending on mental health care skyrocket over the last decade, especially since the pandemic. This is episode 487 of Inside the FLX, and to get some local perspective, we were joined by Margaret Moore. She is the Director of Community Services for Seneca County, and her team has been responsible for some really pioneering work for rural counties in the mental health space. We kick things off with the big question on everyone's mind. How does one define a mental health crisis?
The mental health crisis that I'm dealing with professionally, so I guess maybe I can speak about it personally, because probably there's lots of, depending where you are, what your space is, right? Professionally or personally, it may mean something different to you, is just not having enough resources to meet the needs of young kids, particularly youth, as well as families, adults, elderly who are experiencing significant mental health issues. So for me, the crisis is really not having the resources. We've talked about this before, the issue of Maslow's hierarchy and how really you can't fix, so to speak, if we can even use that word fix, because really it's not about fixing, but you can't really effectively address mental illness, because let's just say that. Because that's different maybe than the mental health crisis, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't really address mental illness, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, these disorders for people, suicidality, when people don't have their basic needs met. And I think more and more we are seeing that these social determinants of health are becoming more and more challenging for people. So for me, it really is about that growing lack of people getting their social determinants of health needs met, housing, food, you know, those basic kinds of needs. And then how that then compounds what might be like biological mental health issues that they're having or substance use issues, how that all kind of works together. Trying to find those resources is more and more challenging. There's that, but then maybe even more crucial at the moment in terms of the mental health crisis from a perspective of a person who operates services, who, you know, is in a leadership role in mental health in my community, is the staffing crisis. And that is a significant issue. So you have the social determinants of health issues, that resource issues, interfacing with the impacts and effects of COVID, right, on kids in particular, but also on adults. And you have that interfacing with a growing staffing crisis. And so really, you can't just throw money, right, at programs. And I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. Like, I am very, very grateful that the state and the federal government are aware and very focused on addressing the substance abuse crisis and the mental health crisis in our communities, and that they're giving us funding to do these things, and they're pushing evidence-based programs and looking to us to develop and create new innovative programs. But if you can't find staff to run these programs, there aren't, you know,
what are you doing?
What are you doing? Exactly. Yeah. So, so sort of long story short, there's a lot of things that feed into how I look at the mental health crisis in my community right now. But the staffing crisis is probably, you know, again, from my perspective, trying to staff programs to serve people is an ever-growing issue that I don't know, you know, exactly what the resolve is. If I did, I'd be a millionaire. But on top of the, you know, another piece of the staffing crisis is that because the acuity, the severity of what we are seeing walk through our door, which is unlike anything I've seen in 35 years of working in human services, people, they're really, really high acuity, very severe symptomologies and things like that. Imagine what that's like for staff. Mm-hmm. They have all sorts of vicarious trauma. People are staying in the field for shorter periods of time because, you know, maybe like myself, I've committed to this field for 35 years. Some people coming out of school or people much younger than me who maybe have graduated in the past 10 years, maybe for their own mental health, they can only do it for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then they have to move on to something else. So there's a lot that goes into it. I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's the things that come to my mind.
You didn't. There's a bunch there that I want to dig more into as we go here, but there's a couple stats that I was going through the NAMI website to try and get a sense of the scope of the problem. And I saw a couple different numbers that I wanted to get your thoughts on, kind of try to explain like how both could be true at the same time, because I'm confident both are true. So the first one I saw was 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness each year. And then the second one that I came across on NAMI's website was around 47% of people actively receive treatment for mental illness each year. So 47% of people who actually have a mental illness actually get treatment for it.
So of the 1 in 5.
Yeah. So it's like, what is the real scope of, because it sounds like there's a much larger population of folks with undiagnosed mental illnesses walking around every day, mm-hmm. then the numbers can even come close to identifying or being able to really like, you know, identify. So how does that lend itself to the work that you guys are doing? Because it seems like, you know, on one hand, you're talking about cases becoming essentially much more severe over time. Mm-hmm. How does that couple up with the fact that you've also probably have a lot of folks with what I guess would be considered low to mid-level types of challenges that are just not being treated in any way, shape, or form and are just kind of becoming part of people's daily behavior without any knowledge or treatment or anything.
Right. So what exactly are you asking me?
How can we be in a spot where mental illness is so prevalent across the board, all age groups, and us also have such a large population of folks walking around with mental illness every day and having absolutely no treatment, no knowledge of, perhaps they don't even know they're experiencing right. it. Like, how can we be at such a, it seems like we've come so far with awareness, and yet at the same time, the data seems to point out that we have like a pretty significant portion of the population that is untreated and just right. going about.
Yeah. Well, I do think stigma plays a huge, yeah. you know, role in that, and that it, you know, even today where we do talk about mental health and mental health disorders so much more than we ever have. Obviously, we talk about substance use disorders more than we ever have. I do think that stigma has been reduced, thankfully, over the years, but it certainly still exists. I think people are, you know, embarrassed to reach out and get help. And their families maybe don't even encourage it because they're embarrassed. What does that mean? Will they be blamed? Does it mean that they're bad parents? Does it mean that they're bad people? So I think that's a major reason why people, you know, don't reach out for help, potentially with mental health disorders. I think it's getting better. I hope, and I sort of hope and pray with kids coming up, because they really are doing so much more focus in the schools and more sort of prevention work in the schools, really working with kids on social emotional learning and these sorts of things, and educating kids about mental health. And so I do think it's becoming more and more acceptable among young people to talk about this stuff. And so I have hope for the future that we will be able to penetrate more. But there are some communities, again, and I think some of it's very cultural. So it depends on what communities you're in, right? So some communities that are far more maybe conservative, for lack of a better way to put that, where there's more of the, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, we help our own, don't sort of air your dirty laundry kind of a thing. That's still very real in some communities. I heard an interesting story just yesterday, actually, where there was a woman who was an engineer. She is currently now like an advocate in the field, lost a child to an overdose, and this child also had a mental health disorder. Obviously, we know that those things are most often co-occurring, right? People are self-medicating emotional pain or symptoms of mental health disorders through use of substances. But this person was working in this workplace where she was talking about the fact that her son was really struggling with the disease of addiction. And she had a coworker whose son was going through cancer treatments. She was brought aside by her supervisor and told, listen, we understand you're going through a lot, but the workplace isn't really the place to air your dirty laundry. So if you could really maybe tone it down and stop talking about that. And she thought, no one's going to my colleague and saying, stop talking about your son's cancer. Stop airing your dirty laundry about your son's cancer. Right. So I think that that is a really great example or illustration of stigma. And I think that does really still exist, right? Like talking about mental health is airing your dirty laundry. Not, it's not the same as, looking and seeking help or reaching out for help for a disease like cancer, which there was a lot of stigma around at one point, the big C in the past, right? There was stigma at one point about talking about that as well. But I think that has a lot to do with it.
In terms of, because it seemed for a very long time that the messaging was, let's make mental health care the same type of conversation as your everyday health care, I guess.
Correct.
Unify these two things. It sounds to me like there's still a long way to go, but it seemed like there were a lot of public campaigns, at least before the pandemic, trying to get there. Has progress been made on that front, despite the fact that there probably still is a lot of prevalence of stigma around it?
Yeah, I think that progress has been made. I think that we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
But I think progress has been made. I think people are far more willing to talk about mental health and substance use disorder. Some of that has to do with, I think in particular, with substance use disorder. And I know you invited me here today to talk about mental health, but I can't separate these things. Mental health and substance use disorder to me are both.
Okay. I'm glad you're saying
that.
This because, okay. So it seems like, especially I can think of actually two or three different times on this program in the last year or so where, this has come up, this topic has come up, and it seems like we're headed toward consensus where, substance use disorders are a mental health, mental health illness that it is the same. So like separating, are people still separating even like in the mental health space, the two, or are they like technically like textbook, are they unified now?
No. So they are still very separated and siloed. And that really is.
Is that not a huge roadblock to just being able to provide the.
Well, it sure is. And I can talk with you about how Seneca County has addressed that. But at the state level and at the federal level, but I'll speak to the state level because that's the space that, for the most part, you know, we live in. They're separated at the funding levels. So, you know, there are separate state agencies that fund services for substance use disorder and then fund services for mental health disorders. So they're siloed at the funding level, at the state level. And so, yeah, how do you truly integrate when you have state agencies essentially vying for funds, you know? I mean, it's...
And I would also assume that lends itself or creates a scenario where there's more red tape for administrators like yourself trying to administer different programs that are on the ground connected directly, but have to be like pushed apart as you go up the chain.
Well, so what Seneca County did in 2018, so I came in as the mental health director in late January of 2017. And then in 2018, with some awareness of this siloing and really sort of myself and the other leaders within my organization feeling very strongly that the best way for us to serve our community was to truly integrate our behavioral health services. We applied to New York State for what's called an integrated license. So, you know, historically we had had two separate outpatient clinics. We had had an addiction clinic and a mental health clinic. And so separate like doors and systems to work through when often a large significant percentage of people were in both services, but you would have to walk through one door and pay for an evaluation for an addictions and then walk through the mental health door and pay for a separate mental health evaluation. And there were separate electronic, you know, charts. So you didn't have like providers in the same building really like coordinating or talking to each other. And, you know, you can imagine, right? So very, very separate, siloed. So we applied for this integrated license. We did receive the license, and we are actually one of very few integrated mental health programs across New York State. And that has been extremely helpful. We integrated our electronic health records. So now there's one door to services. So people don't, you know, come through these separate doors. There's no longer siloing. Our staff are all integrated with each other. Everyone treats everything. We have some specialists who do some, you know, which is great because we have our addiction specialists, our CASACs, who really are, you know, receive very specialized, excellent training in treating addictions and run our groups for us. And for some of our very small population of people who are only there to be treated for substance abuse, and really it's very minimal. Most people are in our integrated services. So I think that that's, you know, so that's one of the ways that we have, tried to address that in Seneca County. However, having said that, at the state level, we still have to split out our revenues, report out to two separate agencies. Our CFRs are still completed for separate systems. So we have to figure out how to do that in our electronic health record, like how to, when you're operating integrated services, like how do you pull out what revenues were for addictions and what revenues were for... So yes, there's like all of this red tape and bureaucracy that makes it really difficult. But we've, you know, we've worked through a lot of those issues, again, since we were at the forefront of that and still continue to be one of the few integrated programs in the state. There's not a lot of, not a whole lot of guidance. Our regional offices at the Office of Mental Health have been really, really helpful to us, but still we sort of have to figure stuff out as we go along. But moving, so in addition to that, we applied for a federal SAMHSA grant last year. It's called a CCBHC grant. I don't know if you're familiar with that acronym. What it means is a Certified Community Behavioral Health Center. This is the federal government's vision for integrated care. And so we did receive that grant, and it is allowing us to further integrate our services with the goal eventually of actually becoming a CCBHC demonstration project, which would then allow us to change the funding methodology for our services so that they will no longer be siloed in that same way. So there are a number of CCBHC demonstration projects in New York State right now, and Governor Hochul gave, she wants 26 more of them. 13 of them were awarded, and they were given startup funds as well last year. And there's another 13 that will be awarded. Three of them will be in our economic development region. So, you know, I have to go through the process with our county board to get permission to apply. But my intention is, with approval from our county board, to apply to become a demonstration. So there are these mechanisms to like help move us forward in that direction. What we've been able to do as a result of the funding we have received from SAMHSA, to which is a program development and implementation grant, is we've brought on a family nurse practitioner to do coordination of primary care and comprehensive health monitoring, because we know that, again, Maslow's hierarchy, right? The population of people that we serve often are stigmatized in the healthcare community, do not receive really good healthcare for a variety of reasons, do not receive good healthcare. Dental care is a huge issue for the population of people that we serve. So we're looking at ways to have one-stop shopping for the people who come and see us. We're developing relationships with our federally qualified health center to provide almost immediate access to primary care through telehealth. We have equipment now from our federally qualified health center where our nurses can assist them in actually receiving physicals right on site in our office. But our grant has allowed us to bring in this family nurse practitioner to help us with that process. We've hired a full-time case manager to be on site, again, to really help people with these social determinants of health that are so important, like housing and food and all, you know, social services, connecting to social services. We do provide transportation and have received funding through our grant to assist us with that as well, because that's a huge issue in our community, as you know. Mm-hmm. If people have Medicaid, they can get Medicaid transport. It's often not reliable. I'll just be honest. We have them cancel on us all the time. Yeah. And then we have to send our driver out. So, you know, being able to provide transportation to people to get to our services is great. But what about getting to the pharmacy to pick up your medications? You know, what about, you know, just think of what it's like for a single mom of three young kids to get on a bus to go food shopping. You know, yeah. I mean, in the rain or in the snow, or you got strollers, you got packages, like how do you even manage that? So trying to think about ways, again, even though we're a behavioral health agency, how can we maybe use funding we're receiving from the federal government to help support these other community services that or develop and collaborate with other agencies who can maybe provide some of those services to, you know, really assist the people that we're working with these other significant issues, which if not resolved, you know, how can they really focus on their mental health and, or really on, you know, how do they have a life that's worth living sober, for example, you know? You really have to work on all these things together. But that's, again, you know, there are these exciting things going on in Seneca County to kind of help us to address the bigger picture. And you hit the nail on the head. It really is about breaking down those silos, treating the whole person, making access to care as easy as possible. Embracing harm reduction approaches as well, I think, is super important because there's lots of barriers to treatment when historically, like 10 years ago, like if you don't do what we say, we're going to discharge you from our services.
Yeah.
You know, that was very much the case for people with substance use. You know, you don't follow the rules. You don't take your medications as we've prescribed. You miss a group. You don't come for your sessions. You can't come here. Like that, we know now that that's not patient-centered care and that that's not helping people, right? If people aren't in front of you, you can't help.
It's less effective, period. Like, right? It's just less effective.
It's less effective, period. And so, you know, how do we meet people where they're at, initially maybe just help them to reduce the harms associated with their illnesses in the hopes that as, you know, that you can kind of help them move along, you know, the continuum of, change, right? Like moving them out of like, well, I think maybe I'd like to make some changes to, you know, I'd like to make some changes. Here's how I'm willing to prepare to make some changes. And, oh, look, I'm making some changes. Like, how can we meet people where they're at and help them along in that process rather than, you know, setting up expectations that aren't even really theirs, they're ours.
It sounds like to me, and I know a lot of people listening or watching are going to think this, they're going to think to themselves, sounds like they're reinventing the wheel. That sounds really complicated. Like, but actually it sounds like everything is really being simplified through this process. It's complicated to get there because hello, bureaucracy. And that's just, that's the way the state and federal government operate. But it is actually simplifying how things are treated in a lot of ways, right?
It is. It's really about creating access, reducing barriers and creating access to services, community organizations working closely together to meet the needs of people. You know, in Seneca County, we've been so lucky. And in some ways, I think being a small community, we have always had to work really closely and collaboratively with our partners because when you have limited resources, you just do that, right? Yeah. You just figure it out. Whereas if you're in a place like, you know, in a city or something, there's maybe even more competition, right? And maybe less natural sense of collaboration. But in Seneca, as long as I've been there in this role, I've always been completely impressed and amazed at how willing all of these amazing small not-for-profit organizations are, and then county departments are how great they are at working together to really try and solve these problems. That's the key, right? So we're ahead of the game in Seneca County, I think, and have been for some time. But again, so the goal really is the methodology that you're describing. Yes, we just need to simplify things, right? Because the easier we can make, the fewer barriers that we can place in front of people to seeking out services, the more likely they are to get them. You know, the traditional, you need to come into the clinic for your services. Maybe that's not great for everyone. So we have more in community services than we've ever had before.
Yeah.
We have more outreach services where, okay, so this person, for whatever reason, a variety of reasons, is on a, whether it's that they have some kind of physical issue, which prevents them from being ambulatory, or maybe it's their mental health that prevents them from going into a larger space. They're too anxious, whatever it might be. We can go to you, you know? So it's about breaking down those barriers, meeting people where they're at, not setting expectations for people that are our expectations as providers, as opposed to what are the goals of the people that we're working with. It has to be their goals. So it's about person-centered, client-centered care, meeting people where they're at, and, being joyful and excited about baby steps.
Yeah.
You know, helping people to take small steps towards change.
You mentioned, and there's a I want to discuss the age range of the folks that you know, mental health professionals in general are working with on a day-to-day basis. But when you talk to your peers in other counties in the area, I'm not talking about Monroe or Onondaga or even Tompkins County for that matter, but, you know, Wayne, Ontario, Yates,
sure,
Cayuga, are all of you guys kind of seeing similar things, or are there things that perhaps because of the population difference between, say, a Wayne in Ontario compared to Seneca and Yates, are there some things that you guys see that are maybe a little different than what they see? Or is it all more or less kind of the same types of challenges?
I think the challenges are very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. Like, we all are dealing with the same types of staffing issues, the same types of, you know, we're seeing the same things in kids coming up in school, the higher acuity, and the more significant comorbidities among the population of people that we're serving. So substance use disorders, mental health disorders, developmental disabilities, all being present in one individual. And, you know, how do you get all of these different systems together to, you know, effectively assist people? So I think that we are seeing very similar things. In some situations, what's different, right, for Seneca, maybe in particular, although maybe, again, some other of the smaller rural counties would have some similar issues. You know, some of the stuff that we have challenges with are around, like, effective data collection. Hmm. That's a real challenge for us in Seneca, like knowing exactly how many suicides we have, how many overdoses we have, how much naloxone is being administered in our community. You know, we don't have the same resources that some of the larger counties have, where they actually have, like, data analysts that are specifically devoted to just that.
Yeah.
And as a result of not having really great data, we miss out on opportunities. So the number of overdose deaths that get reported, for example, in Seneca is really low. I think it's completely off base. I'm quite certain that we have many more overdose deaths than are likely reported. And whether that is, you know, because it's being reported as, you know, a cardiovascular event at the hospital as opposed to an overdose, or at the coroner level. I mean, I'm not exactly certain, but I know we're not getting the best data that we can. And so on a lot of the, like, state level dashboards on overdose and suicide, you know, on some of these metrics, you'll see where we are black, like, we have no data. It just says, you know, not enough data to, you know, to report. And so, you know, that's unfortunate. So that's one of the differences, I think, is because we're so small and because we have less, maybe, you know, resources that certainly, like, even Wayne would have, for example.
Sure.
We don't get the same kind of data collection, which then we miss out on certain opportunities. Having said that, I think, again, in general, we are all seeing very, very similar trends.
The themes and the trends are uniform,
yes,
pretty
the
much.
The themes
around.
And the trends are the same. You know, some of the opportunities are different because of that data stuff. For some reason, and I don't know what it is. I mean, we're looking really closely at it, but suicide rates in Seneca County right now are it's really, really sad to talk about, but unlike anything we have seen, yeah, we are completely spiked.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So let me just interject here, because I this is something that the news person and the journalist in me has wrestled with a lot, especially in recent years, because especially since the pandemic, I feel like there's been this desire for some counties, some agencies, law enforcement. I've heard it from different groups. like, there's a desire to paint a rosier picture than might actually be real. Saying, you know, we're seeing declines in overdoses. We're seeing declines in, and I think about, you're not the first person to say it, but the underreporting in all of these things, whether you're talking about suicide, whether you're talking about overdoses, fatal or non-fatal, we don't have a good, it doesn't seem like we have a good grasp on the situation. And it's always kind of like struck me, kind of like I almost don't want, part of me doesn't even want to touch it because it's such a like, I feel like perpetuating the idea that things are getting better when they aren't just undermines everything. It's like undermines the care, undermines the treatment, undermines the awareness that people need to have with these things. How as a mental health professional in that space, like how do you deal with that when you have, when you know you're working with incomplete data in the best case scenario?
Right.
Like it seems to me like that would be perhaps one of the most frustrating things that you could possibly be dealing with day in and day out, because one, that is undermining the grants you're able to get, right? So it's impacting the care that you can provide. But then also it just kind of has this cooling effect, I guess, in terms of like pushing it to the back of people's minds instead of keeping it in the forefront where it needs to be if we are going to make progress over the next like 5 to 10 years on this, meaningful progress.
Yeah. So it's a really, really good question. I feel like in Seneca County, despite the fact that our data is not accurately showing to the state and to the, you know, to the government entities, what's really going on in our community, the people in our community know.
Yeah.
Right. So, I don't think you could talk to a board of supervisor in Seneca County who wouldn't, if you asked them, is there a mental health crisis? Is there a drug crisis in Seneca County? Who at this point in time would tell you no?
Yeah.
Which is probably a big change from 10 years ago, I would imagine. I mean, I wouldn't know because I wasn't engaging with them. Even though I was a community member, I wasn't like involved at that level. Our community knows that this is what's going on. So the frustration you're describing for me really is about, you know, how can I, in my role, make the funding entities aware of the problems that we're having? I don't need to do that really in the community as much because they're very well aware of what's going on around them because it's their family members, it's their loved ones. It's not, you know, no one is left out.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, thankfully, as a result, we get tons of support from our county board for programs and, you know, really we get all of the support we could possibly ever want to move forward with, you know, all of the things that we're trying to do. And then, you know, we just have to be very creative in leadership when we're writing grants to, you know, talk about those, we can't point to actual data that's being reported to them, but we can share with them what we are seeing and experiencing.
Yeah.
And so far we've been successful. So in that, so, you know, we've received, you know, $2.9 million, back in, I guess, was that 21 to build our 24/7 mobile crisis team, which has been wildly successful. We are completely functional at this point. So we have a 24/7 crisis response team. We work hand in hand with our law enforcement, who are the best law enforcement. I'm just going to say it, in the state of New York, Seneca County law enforcement is the very best. They are amazing. All of our law enforcement are trained in crisis intervention. They get the full 40 hours. We, you know, at mental, in our, you know, our crisis team director, myself, the senior mental health counselor in our jail, we all participate in those trainings. We work, you know, so we're doing tons of co-response into the community. You know, we are just, we're very, very blessed to have such incredible leadership in law enforcement and amazing men and women, you know, working in our law enforcement. They are just incredible. I mean, they're basically social workers, honestly, and they do an incredible, incredible job. We love working with them. And I think it's made a huge difference. I have no doubt that we have prevented suicides, that we have prevented terrible things from happening by having this crisis team in place. Because not only do they respond when there's a mental health crisis, but they do all sorts of interim supports for people, you know, checking on people when people don't show up for, you know, when high-risk individuals don't show up for their appointments, they're reaching out, they're checking on them, they're bringing them to services, you know. So we're really, I think, doing some really exciting stuff around that. But it's frustrating not to have good data, but we are working on that. So we have an opioid task force right now. And so we're working on trying to find ways to get better data around overdoses. And we're also, you know, working with the New York State Suicide Prevention Department and office, and we are working with local providers around thinking about ways to get better data on suicides. We have since, you know, I work really closely with public health, and so we do get those death certificates, so we do know, but then again, not all deaths are determined to be suicide when maybe they are. So there is a lot of work to be done. Yeah. What is frustrating is that we're doing all of this really, like little old Seneca County, we are doing all of this incredible, like state-of-the-art, evidence-based programming, like the stuff that the federal government is coming out and saying, people should be co-responding with mental health into the community. Well, okay, we've been doing that for 3 years now, right? Yeah. Which is great. You know, you need to be doing medication-assisted treatment in your jails. You have to do, we've been doing this for years, you know? Yeah. So we've really been like incredibly ahead of the mark or ahead of the game. Having said that, it is like, gosh, but you know, we're still, like we just see rising suicide numbers and rising overdose numbers. So, you know, all of this incredible work that we're doing, yet we still see a growing problem. What I say to my staff and to people who have this conversation with me is I am convinced that if not for all of the work that we were doing, it would be a lot worse, right? So I still think that what we're doing has been incredibly effective. I think that the crisis we're seeing would be far greater in our community if we hadn't put in all of these really innovative services.
Speaking of innovative, or I guess just flat out impressive, especially for the layperson like myself, I've spoken with some folks, professionals in mental health, particularly therapists over the last couple of years, and the uptick that they're seeing and more people seeking out therapy and mental health and prioritizing it, excuse me, which is great, right? But they'll tell me, you know, relatively quickly they have to specialize. So they focus on certain things, right? Mm-hmm. And here you guys are. Mm-hmm. When I say specialize, I mean focusing on one or two types of mental illnesses or focusing on specific age groups or focusing on specific, whatever the parameters you want to put on it, mm-hmm. really narrow. I would assume you guys are interacting with young children all the way up to elderly adults. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 10, 15, 30, 50, 70, 80, all of the above. 90. Like, okay, so walk me through how that is mm-hmm. possible. Mm-hmm. Because on one hand, it's mighty impressive. But on the other hand, mm-hmm. I mean, it is, there's the obvious question of like, how is it possible?
Mm-hmm. So we work with children, children ages 4 and up and then adults up to, you know, infinity, right? We do have specific staff that are specialized in working with kids.
Okay.
So we have 8 school-based satellites. So we have clinicians, we have satellite clinics of our main clinic in Waterloo in every single school in Seneca County, except for Frank Knight. And now they're asking for one. So I'm going to work on that, but, which is great. Again, staffing is always an issue.
Sure.
So we do have, individual clinicians who come into us upon, you know, when they're interviewing, who have to have a specific interest in working with kids. And then of course, they receive additional like specialized training and things like that to do that work with kids. Having said that, the expectation of our clinic-based, like our main site clinic, like our Ovid clinic, and then our Waterloo clinic, is that the people coming in are generalists, you know? And so we have used a lot of grant funding to provide all sorts of training opportunities for our staff. And, you know, so we're doing a lot of like cross training, like a lot of substance abuse training for our mental health licensed staff, a lot of mental health training for our addictions specialists. So really, you know, trying to help people to be able to do interventions around all of the things. I think the biggest issue really is more about children versus adults than it is schizophrenia versus depression versus trauma.
Right.
At least in our experience, you know, there are some people who just don't like working with kids, and we might say, well, you have to be a generalist to work here, but do you really want to assign someone who's like, I don't really want to work with kids to a
right.
kid, you know?
Right.
So for us, we do really try to specialize in that way because, you know, working with kids and families is a very different thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have a very specialized skill set and interest in working with that population. So we do sort of specialize in that way. But in terms of specific diagnoses, we don't have the luxury in a county, in a community mental health center or a community behavioral health center, which is what we are, to, you know, specialize in that way.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in private practice, you can cherry pick, but that's, we don't have that luxury. We have to be able to help whoever comes to our door. And it takes a very specific kind of professional who wants to do that work, right? And as I shared earlier, I think before we had the cameras on, before we were taping, you know, what we're finding is that for a lot of the younger people coming out of master's programs, because we do hire a lot of people right out of school, in a staffing crisis, that's kind of one of the, you know, one of the ways that we can be successful is really recruiting right out of school. And then we, you know, really get people who are excited and fresh, and we can train, you know, we train them and really support and mentor them. Obviously, we have very skilled supervisory supports for those people. But, you know, I'm coming to terms with the fact that it's just not what it was once, right? If we can get someone, if we can retain a clinician for 5 years, we should be really excited about that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, maybe sort of, again, I've been doing this for 35 years, right? You know, it was just different, right? So people, especially community behavioral health, because we are working with the neediest, maybe sickest, for lack of a better way to put it. I don't want to be stigmatizing in it, but it is illness, right? So
sure.
The highest acuity individuals, there is a very high burnout rate. There's only so long that some people can do that work. And, you know, we want our staff to be healthy. So a lot of our staff, you know, what happens is they move on into private practice with these telehealth work from home organizations. That's a huge crisis for us in community mental health.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people want to, you know, they can work from home full time.
Yeah.
They can pick and choose what cases, you know, they're not going to be working with, you know, homeless people with schizophrenia and, you know, heroin addictions. And that's, you know, they can work from home and they can work in much less with much less trauma, I guess. And so I don't blame them, but I guess it's just a different mindset.
How have your staffers who've been with you for a longer period of time, say more than that 5-year window?
Yeah.
How do they do it, or how have they done it? What are the things that you see out of them that allow them to be able to sort of, I guess, probably create the balance that they need to create? Like, how are they doing that? Because you're dealing with some really, like, frankly, traumatizing things on a daily basis.
Absolutely. So a lot of what we've done in leadership to try and help support them is this approach to, like, integrating our care, right? So prior to me coming into my role, all the crisis work was done by the clinicians. Like, we had crisis rotation. So you're a clinician, you have 80 people on your caseload, you're seeing people all day long, but you're on crisis rotation. So someone walks in a crisis, you got to stop everything, and then you have to deal with that. So by building our crisis response team, we've offered tons of, you can't even, now that we have this team, I can't even believe how we did it before. It's just like, I can't even.
It seems unmanageable.
How did we do that? And it was unmanageable, right? So I think that's been super helpful and in decreasing trauma for our staff and giving them a better balance. We were successful in being able to provide opportunity to our staff for a hybrid remote schedule. Mm-hmm. They were fully remote during COVID.
Sure.
And then we brought them all back in. And then, we were able to give them the opportunity to work from home 2 days a week in remote offices. And that's been huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just their productivity increased working from home. And I think that in many ways, that's because it increases their personal wellness.
Yeah.
To be at home around their pets, around, you know, it's just... We all learned that in COVID, right? I mean, it just, so many people found that was the case for them. So that's, I think, been very helpful. A lot of the people who come into this field and are successful, I think are people who are in recovery themselves, quite frankly. They are really, really good at taking care of themselves because they're continuously focused on their own recovery.
Yeah.
So they're using all of their own recovery tools. They're going to meetings. They're meeting with their therapists. They're, you know, doing whatever it is. Their spiritual practices. I find that honestly, some of the healthiest people who are best at taking care of themselves, I guess it isn't surprising, are people who are really working strong recovery programs. And, you know, so they're doing this work and they have a really good ability to take care of themselves because it's necessary for their own recovery. Some people, again, you know, I think it, particularly like the younger people coming in, I'm just seeing, you know, they're just going to be in it for less time.
Yeah.
But for those of us like myself who have been doing this for 35 years, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just something that maybe there is just something about us, that something about our makeup,
yeah,
that allows us to do this and keep a work-life balance. I think for me personally, I love it so much. Like, I really love it so much. It can be very, you know, the things you hear, it can be very traumatic. But I just, every day that I come to, I know it's just, you know, it sounds goofy. You probably shouldn't even put this on the air because people are going to be like, well, who is this woman? But I literally love to go to work every day. So I think people who have a passion for this, that's what it is. They have a passion for it. And so if you really love what you're doing and you have a passion for it, then, you know, it's all worthwhile.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we are constantly focusing on staff wellness. As I mentioned, we use a lot of our grant funds to support our staff, to make sure that they're able to go to conferences, you know, do things with their fellow coworkers. We do monthly potlucks. We do retreats. We purchased 2 massage chairs. Yeah. So we have like a massage room now where there's like a music set up and people can put headphones on and take a break and get a massage. You know, we're constantly celebrating people's birthdays and doing parties and just really trying to make the workplace a place that is someplace that people want to come to.
Yeah. Social media, this is the last topic I wanted to talk about with you. It's impossible to have a conversation about mental health and the mental health crisis in this country without social media coming up. Mm-hmm. From your vantage point, what role has social media played in creating the situation we have now? And the second part of that is, do you ever feel like social media has become a bit of a scapegoat to try and simplify a very complicated problem?
I think it's a very complicated problem, but I think that social media plays a significant role. So yes and yes, both.
When it comes to social media, what's doing the most damage within the social media experience that people are? Is it social media when the exposure at a young age? Mm-hmm. Is it the constant nonstop dopamine hit that people are getting because of the constant notifications? Is it some combination of those things, or is it something else completely?
I think it's a combination of those things. I definitely think that, and I think research is showing that. I know there's a lot of different research out there. From my perspective, the research that seems to show direct correlation in increase in anxiety, depression, and suicide among teens, like directly related to social media usage, to me, it seems pretty clear. I do think some of that is about kids at very young ages. I think it changes the way our brains function. You know, I think that it, you know, when I even think about my own kids, like, you know, they thankfully, you know, I have a 21-year-old and a 19-year-old. So when you think about it, when they were in that, you know, in elementary school and middle school, social media isn't what it is for those kids today. So I'm really grateful for that, because I'm not sure how I would have, you know, managed that. But I do think that, you know, bullying and never getting away from it. So there's all of that, right? But then there's also, I think, the very real impact on brain development for young kids, and just being in front of a screen constantly. Attention deficit disorders. I mean, that is obviously not necessarily just caused or caused by use of social media, but we know that it can absolutely contribute to the ability for kids to focus, you know, when they're just constantly on TikTok and used to like these very quick kinds of things. Listen, I mean, what was some of the most recent CDC stuff that came out? I mean, I don't know that this is the exact number. It's what's coming to mind, but what, 34% of teenage girls report that they have felt suicidal and have had a plan to kill themselves. 34%.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. There are some, you know, recently I heard a statistic, or I heard someone said to me that there was some study that showed that the level of anxiety and depression that kids are experiencing today, that would have deemed them eligible for inpatient hospitalization in the 50s. So, you know, we definitely have a growing problem. I think it is a very complicated problem. So I'm not interested in, you know, I'll never be reductionistic, right? I'm not going to reduce it to one thing. But from my perspective, and I haven't done the research, but, you know, I've read a lot of it. From my perspective, social media absolutely plays a significant role. And for, you know, a variety of reasons. I mean, there's studies that, you know, they've done in schools where they've taken away the phones and, you know, and they've seen like just in 1 month, when they, like, you know, whatever their methodologies are, screening kids for depression and anxiety, just taking away phones for 1 month, like, significantly reduced rates of depression and anxiety. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, there's a direct correlation.
Yeah. I want to end on a positive note.
Yes.
One thing as you look forward 5, 10, 15 years, what's one thing that gives you optimism about where we're headed?
I think that, you know, I work with, like, just the best people. I see people all around me who are just the most wonderful, committed people to this field. And I think that, and quality, incredible, incredible quality among service providers. So I have great hope that there will continue to be wonderful providers of service, very smart providers of service, doing really good, effective work. So that gives me a lot of hope. I also believe in the resilience of children and people. I believe strongly that people can make positive changes. I see it around me every day. I see people getting better. And I think that the focus on that our government, where, and I mentioned that because, of course, that's where we get the funding and the resources we need to do this work. You know, there is a growing focus and commitment to improving, to addressing these problems. And I do think stigma is decreasing. I see it in my own community. So I have great hope that things are moving in the right direction. But, you know, baby steps. We have to be happy with even, you know, small progress.
Yeah, a lot of work ahead for sure.
A lot of work ahead, but yeah. I feel very, very hopeful that things are moving in the right direction. And I'm grateful to be in the community that I am, because I see lots of progress in my own community.
Absolutely. Margaret, I'm grateful for the time. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks.